If you want access to bonus episodes, reading lists for every series of Empire, a chat community, discounts for all the books mentioned in the week's podcast, ad-free listening, and a weekly newsletter, sign up to Empire Club at www.empirepoduk.com.
Sag mal, hast du bei der Steuer auch diesen Schulflashback? Einfach irgendwas raten und dann hoffen, dass es stimmt?
Boah, nee, gar nicht. Wieso, Steuer ist so mein Safe Space?
Du meinst, damit ist alles sicher?
Ja, genau. Wieso, Steuer ist so die Steuer-App, die dich einfach versteht. Egal ob Studium, Job oder Umzug.
Stimmt, krass. Fühlt sich gar nicht wie Steuern an.
Steuern erledigt?
Safe.
Mit Wieso, Steuer?
Hello and welcome to Empire with me, Anita Anand.
And me, William Dirrymple.
I can see the thought going through your mind.
And me, Anthony Sutton.
Well, you're not even announced yet. You just be quiet. I know you well enough to see that look where you go, shall I do it? Shall I tip her over at the beginning of this one? And you almost did. Anyway.
It never fails.
And it really does. And also, can I just ask all of you who are on Twitter having a campaign to bring back the pause, you're not helping my mental health, any of you. So anyway, we're here again. And listen, we've got a very special guest who also, like William, doesn't understand about the dramatic build-up. Just wait until you're properly introduced. It's like having two children. These two are like two very good friends.
Coming.
Listen, on the previous podcast, we have been, this is part of, if you're just joining us for this one-off, it's not normally this chaotic, I promise. There's normally more order to these podcasts. But we are talking about the Ottoman Empire. We have taken you from its inception to the rise through Suleiman the Great. We've taken you through to the Young Turks arriving, yes, coffee, and also we're sort of coming to the tipping point in the decline of the whole empire. And we thought, William, it would be good to look at that decline through a really interesting, kind of ubiquitous, at least in Britain, prism. We are doing it through the life of
Lawrence of Arabia, and yeah. I think most people who have encountered Lawrence have encountered Peter O'Toole. It's the movie.
Peter O'Toole, yeah.
One of the great movies.
Yeah.
In fact, I watched it in Egypt over Christmas. So I am very ginned up on what the movie is, but I'm quite keen to talk to our guest.
Who just not going to stay quiet for a moment longer.
The sooner we introduce him, the better.
Go on then. It is actually the rather marvellous Anthony Sutton, who is a very old friend of yours, it's true to say.
Old friend of mine. Yeah,
well, young, 30 years ago. Yeah, young. Long friend.
30 years ago, really?
Yes.
Well, and you have done this beautiful book with a really fetching cover, I have to say, Young Lawrence, and it's got a picture. It could be O'Toole. It could be one of those smudgy pictures from an O'Toole poster, film poster.
Except that Lawrence was actually much shorter than O'Toole, isn't that right?
Yes, wow. I know. Yeah, exactly.
Poor. How tall was he?
He was short. Well, we don't know exactly how short he was, but he was between 5'2" and 5'4". And because there are several medical records.
How tall are you?
I'm 5'2". I'm not even
he's
between.
He's your size.
I'm just so shocked. He's fun size. He's not even a real old person. I just can't understand this. I can't compute it.
You could have looked each other in the eye. It could have been something. Oh, he's a bit old.
Oh,
for you.
A bit dead for me, to be honest, Anthony. And also, I don't think I'm necessarily his type. And we'll get to that in a minute.
Yes. Let's not rush forward. That.
But can I just tell you a really interesting fact about the O'Toole film version? Because he became so much identified with Lawrence. So there are some things that they did right. So he was this creature with a shock of very blonde hair. That is correct.
That's right, yes.
He had piercing blue eyes. That is correct.
That's correct.
He was half the size of Peter O'Toole. We've now found out. That is also. But when Peter O'Toole was making the film, do you know what his nickname was on set?
Tell me.
Florence of Arabia, because he was so appalling to all the cast and crew. They found him really, really flouncy and awful. They called him Florence of Arabia. Thought I'd throw that in. Right, back to reality though. So where was Lawrence of Arabia? He was not always of Arabia. He was Lawrence of where to begin with?
Well, he was born in Wales, Lawrence of Tremadoc. And then he became Lawrence of Oxford, which is where he was brought up. He went to.
Anita's convinced that she went to school with him.
No, I had a discussion that whatever that case was in my school was a big lie.
It was an absolute lie.
They used to claim him. It's not true.
They claimed him in a glass cabinet saying he went to this school and it was a ragged schoolboy in the East End of London.
No, he didn't. He went to the Oxford High School.
Yeah, yeah. It was a big, big lie. But his actual origin story, if I sort of use the Marvel comic nomenclature of this, is complicated. It's it's not clean. Tell us about his background.
No, I mean, well, the name wasn't Lawrence for a start. I mean, he didn't discover this as a fact until after the war. But he has a sense, and he's one of five children, four other brothers. But he's the only one who has a sense there's something weird about his parents' relationship. And what's weird about it is that A, they're not called Lawrence, and B, that his parents are not married, which at the beginning of the 20th century was quite a big thing. So his father was an Irish baronet by the name of Chapman, who ran off with the governess, got her pregnant, and then did the indecent thing of leaving his wife and daughters. But his wife was a Catholic and wouldn't divorce him. So they live in sin.
They live in sin. And is this a big scandal at the time? Do people know? Or has he by moving to Oxford and does he have money of his own?
He's got money, yes. I mean, yeah. He's left the estate and most of the fortune to his wife.
Right.
But he's got enough never to have to work. So he sort of lives this sort of comfortable middle-class life as though he was a lawyer or something like that. And they move around. So his elder brother was born in Dublin, and he's the second one born in Wales, and the third one's born in Normandy or Brittany, and then the next one's born in the Channel Islands, and the last one in the New Forest. And then when it's school time, they decide to go to Oxford. And I think because they feel they can live anonymously in Oxford. There's no social life. There's no family, you know, family backstory. There's no, you know, the wee Lawrences come from wherever it is. But after the war, old man Lawrence dies of the Spanish flu in 1919 and leaves this heart-rending letter that says, you know, oh, my sons, if only I had known, you know, there could never be a divorce. I've lived with this secret all my life, and this awful, awful sort of weight.
But they only find out when he dies.
He leaves a letter to be opened after his death.
But with this sort of unusual background, albeit he doesn't know how unusual it is, is it true to say that as a child, he was a bit weird?
Yeah. But as I said, he's the only one of these five kids who feels there's something weird about his parents. And it really weighs on him. So he's convinced that his mother is his mother, but his father is not. And that this man has stepped in to do the decent thing, you know, to sort of protect this woman. So, and he has a very, very complex relationship with his mother, who, of all the kids, she beats him quite savagely at times and punishes him a lot. And also he's literally the runt of the litter, although he's the second of five, because he's small and the others are not that small. You know, there's something weird about him.
Is he clever?
He's very, very bright, and he's very dedicated to building up his body. He goes on, first of all, long walks, and then when he gets a bicycle, long bike rides. And by long, I mean he cycles down to the south of France.
Oh, wow.
And back. I mean, he does long.
And then, crucially, he decides to go and see Crusader castles.
Crucially, yes. His second year at Oxford, where he's studying medieval history, he decides to go and look for the origin of, well, various elements of Crusader castles. He becomes obsessed with machiculation, which is the bit that hangs above the gate of a castle where you can pour boiling oil down onto the people trying to batter your door. I mean,
it's quite niche.
It's very niche. And on the year that the summer holiday at the end of his first year at Oxford, he'd cycled down the whole way around France to, looking at castles. And then in his second summer, he decides to walk around the Middle East.
And, you know, I actually did the same. I did it in my first summer at Cambridge. I went off and followed the route of the Crusade.
You're much taller than him.
You're taller, but you are as odd. I mean, that's probably fair to say.
And I arrived in Damascus, and I was staying with some friends of friends in Damascus, and someone gave me this book of Lawrence's Crusader Castles,
which is
so his, you didn't know why you were doing no it, that you were following in his footsteps.
Which was his thesis, yeah, which he received first.
So he got a first. He's acknowledged as a brain. He has this niche interest
in
a particular bit of Crusader Castles. Okay, so what is to become of such a man?
Well,
is there a career in matriculation?
He's even weirder than that, because he'd actually been collecting shards of pots and bits of broken glass. They were digging up roads in Oxford. They were doing a lot of construction when he was growing up.
Yeah.
And he paid the workmen to give him whatever little bits they dug. And he reconstructed medieval pots and Elizabethan bottles and things. And he became the youngest ever donor to the Ashmolean Museum. And then he helped them reorder at age 16 or whatever their collection of medieval stuff.
Wow.
I mean, he was a complete nutter.
But I think he's rather lovely though, but kind of charming nutter.
Yes.
Actually.
You've always liked that kind of nutter.
That's why we're friends. Just saying. Okay, so.
And crucially, he of the five kids is the one who tells stories at night when they're all little. And the stories he tells are always Arthurian legends. They're stories of knights doing noble things, saving young ladies, storming castles.
So he's romantic. He's got a deeply romantic soul.
Yes.
But he's not a romantic person at this time. And he's not sort of, you know, a hit with the ladies. That's not his thing at all, is it?
That's not his thing at all. No, he's a loner at this point.
One of the things that you've said in your book that was I hadn't realized is I always assumed he was gay, and you say he wasn't. He was basically asexual.
I have found no dirty sheets, and believe me, I've looked. Even someone who wrote thinking it was rather odd that he'd spent a summer locked up with a young man in the Ottoman Empire, then quickly backtracked at saying, I'm not suggesting anything improper happened, but he did carve an image of a naked man.
Did he? Well, we've all done that. The thing is, though, let's not leap forward, because here he is. Okay, he's doing something interesting.
Is he looking at these matriculations?
1908.
And then what happens? So he's got a narrow relationship with the Ashmolean. The Ashmolean is going to be a real pivot point in his life, transformative. What happens?
Yes, there's a man called Hogarth. D.G. Hogarth, who's such a shady character. He had been an archaeologist and then a journalist. He didn't have money. He didn't inherit money, so he'd had to make it. And he was a very popular public speaker. And then he became director of the Ashmolean in Oxford. And he sort of becomes Lawrence's surrogate father and looks after him. So he helps him into Oxford into the university, because he knew him beforehand. And, you know, suggests that he might go and look at Crusader castles in France, and then helps him arrange the big walk he makes around the Middle East
around
in
the
his
Middle
second
East.
Year.
Now, you say shady. Is that because you think he might be a feeder school for spooks? I'm trying to understand the kind of flavor shady that we're talking about.
I think he's a spook of some sort. I think it was about him that Churchill said it was unhealthy for so much power to be in the hands of a man of whom nobody understood his origins or his trajectory. And, you know, he's a friend of everybody. I mean, he's the director of a museum. You know, and an archaeologist.
Pinnacle of respectability.
Yes, exactly. But but behind that, he appears to have been doing also. But for instance, when I spent a lot of time trying to find information about him, the Ashmolean have nothing.
They have no records.
They say the files have been weeded. Was the word they
weeded,
used.
Which means someone's gone through,
which means someone's gone through
things.
And cleared it out. Yeah,
that's
and there
intriguing.
Were and somebody some years earlier had done a PhD on him, and I tracked this person down who said, "I've left academia as though that her PhD had ended her life, and I'm now working in a bar somewhere in the outback Australia or whatever." But I found her, and she said they have a copy of my PhD at the Ashmolean, and they swore they didn't. And I did eventually get it. And well, he ends up running the Arab Bureau in Cairo during the First World War.
Okay. So he's been recruited. Let's just imagine that, what you're suggesting, he's been recruited into what is the equivalent of, I suppose, MI6 or whatever it is. And he's then sent out on this walk,
and
which
so,
is important.
Yes, give us a picture of the Ottoman Levant in 1909
by the time he gets to Beirut. The Ottoman Levant, like the rest of the Ottoman Empire, is in a state of flux because the Young Turks in 1908 had taken power, but they'd had a sort of power-sharing agreement effectively with the Ottoman Sultan. But in 1909, they literally deposed the Sultan. This has resulted in a real sort of turmoil in the regions, and everything that we're going to talk about here, the Middle East, what we call the Middle East, Anatolia and Palestine and Syria and the whole way around into Egypt, is in flux.
So what is left of the Ottoman Empire at this period?
They still have some European provinces. There's still Bulgaria, Montenegro,
and other bits,
Greece, exactly, Macedonia, and still the whole way down through Syria, what is now Syria, the Asian part of Turkey, what's now Jordan, Israel, Palestine.
So, I mean, they've got a lot, but...
Egypt is still nominally...
What does it pay tribute to the Ottomans, but it looks after itself?
The British
had
invaded in 1882, so it's a British occupied, but they never, it's called the Veiled Protectorate because the British don't sort of annex it. So it's still nominally part of the Ottoman Empire with the king.
The Khedive.
And then Libya. is still part of the Ottoman territory.
Okay, so he's walking through what is, it feels like, an empire in decline. What does he form an opinion of what he thinks Turks or Ottoman Turks are like?
Yes, in several times in his letters home and in his journals, there's this word, stupid. He keeps on calling them stupid. He said, these people simply do not understand how to run an empire. And he's watching, you know, the last bit of grip that they have. And while he's walking around, because the Sultan has gone, there's a sense among the minorities, and that's most of the region we're talking about, that this might be their moment for independence. Mm. So the Armenians, the Kurds, the, you know, all the tribes.
Beginnings of some Arab nationalist stuff in
Beirut. Exactly.
When he's arriving.
The Arab nationalists. And you know, so there's a lot of tension. And which is why he's told, A, not to walk, and B, not to walk alone.
And he ignores both things.
Yeah. This
little teeny tiny blonde man.
You know, he's not an Englishman. He's not a Welshman. He's actually an Irishman by blood. Goes off walking with a little backpack with a camera and a revolver and a change of clothes.
So is this his way into the Arab culture? There's something that he becomes very enamored of. I mean, some may say in a quite orientalist kind of way, but he has this romantic notion of what it is to be Arab. Does he literally knock on people's doors saying, I'm here now, I need somewhere to sleep? Is that how it works?
It is literally that. There are, you know, most of the places where he walks, there are no hotels. So when you go into a village and there's this, you know, this wonderful thing, which there still is in a lot of the Middle East, of hospitality.
Right.
You're welcomed in.
Even when I was doing this in the 1980s, at same age, walking through the villages of Syria. And again, many of these places didn't have hotels and all I had was a backpack. People just took you in.
So, I mean, just talk about that a bit more.
One of the reasons I feel
more.
So sad for Syrians who've arrived in Europe and been given very opposite of that kind of hospitality. Every single night of my first trip to Syria, I was taken in by someone, given a bed, fed, and given a little food the next day to go off on my next trip.
So tell me this. I mean, because I've always wondered, because, you know, I've never had the luxury of doing that. I suppose it's different, actually, when you're a woman, you're not...
It's a
male thing. Unless
you're Gertrude Bell.
Yes.
Or Freya Stark, it's a male thing.
We'll come on to, actually, Gertrude Bell and Lawrence of Arabia do cross paths. But when you were doing it, was it with an absolute... I'm trying to get into his head, you know, that... Do you feel immortal at that age?
No, not at all.
The adventure overrule good sense? Frightened.
I mean, I was also looking at Crusader castles, following Crusader routes, and I remember one night... I went with a friend, so I wasn't alone, unlike Lawrence. But I remember one night we arrived at Kalat Salah Hedin Sayun, which is one of the most spectacular...
Wonderful
Why
place.
Is it spectacular?
Because they dug out... there was a very an eminence on three sides, cliff faces on three sides, but on the fourth, there wasn't. So they just dug out the rock and created the most enormous ditch, leaving one tiny thing for the drawbridge.
For a drawbridge.
It's the most romantic castle in the world. Wow. We arrived there at night. The castle was already locked. Wow. And so we just put down our sleeping mats and slept outside. And then in the middle of the night, we started hearing the howling of wolves.
Oh.
And they got closer.
Oh,
and,
dear.
And that's an uncomfortable moment when you're 18 or 19. And, and I didn't have a revolver. Anyway, but
you could knock on a door and someone would take you in.
Hospitality is a huge thing in that part of the world, a very real thing.
But also the need to explain who you are. So it's like, where have you come from?
Right.
And why are you here and where are you going? I don't know if you had this, Willie, but certainly Lawrence did. And you start with a limited vocabulary. Because although in Lebanon, he found a lot of people spoke English. He kept on meeting people who'd gone off to the States to make some money and come back, and so
quite a lot like that now, isn't it? Really,
but it is actually.
Yeah.
But the further he went on, the less English there was, and the more Arabic. And he begins to learn. I mean, he had studied a bit before, but he begins to learn.
So
Arabic.
He becomes actually sort of a triple threat. I don't know whether Hogarth sent him out with this in his mind, but he's learning the terrain, he's making contacts with people, and he's learning the language. Is he aware? Is there any awareness inside him at all that he's actually, you know, sort of being molded into rather a super spy when needed?
There's something you really have to be really careful about with Lawrence, and that is there's so much mythologizing after the war, because he ends the First World War as the one of the most famous, and very soon the most famous, survivor. And therefore, everybody around him starts mythologizing, and he adds to it by giving out different accounts and then mythologizing his own account. So he said later on, he says, yes, I was preparing myself for this great work, but I don't believe it.
I've always assumed, I have to say, that he was into his matriculations. Crusader castles are wonderful things to go and see. You don't need to go and create an entire spy persona for him just because later he ended up in the First World War doing.
No, he was just a bit of a weird nerd who was clearly not a team player, because I mean, he says at school they kept on getting him to play team games and he would walk off halfway through. He was not a team player.
So he's done his now long epic walk. There are no soles left on his sandals. He's done whatever he could. Then what do you do? What do you do after that? You've had all this adventure. What happens?
Oh, you go back and finish your degree, get your first at Oxford. Yeah. And then, well, then he thought he was given a fellowship, Magdalen College, and given a grant to go and study medieval glass somewhere in France. But then Hogarth again gets a grant to go and excavate this site called Carchemish,
which is one of the great archaeological sites of the Middle East.
Why is it? Describe it to those who don't know, because I don't know about it.
It was a Hittite site.
It was a Hittite site.
And it was dug by Leonard Woolley.
That's right. Yeah. And the British Museum didn't want it. What the British Museum wanted was a place called Hattusa, which is in the middle of Anatolia, the middle of Asian Turkey, which was the Hittite capital. And the big thing about Hittites at that time was nobody had translated their script. So everyone was looking for the equivalent of the Rosetta Stone, something that would have several
this
scripts.
Is still a period when people are really trying to find the archaeology of the Bible, and Hittites appear in the Bible. So all these sort of people at the early 20th century are trying to establish the truth behind the biblical narrative still.
So the Germans get Hattusa, German archaeologists. Okay. There's real nationalism in this.
So when you go to Berlin, you see all the stuff from it there in the Berlin.
Exactly. And the British Museum gets Carchemish. And Carchemish, it sits on the Euphrates River. So it's, it's important. And it was thought because it was the frontier of the Hittite Empire, maybe there would be a bi or a trilingual inscription. And it also happens to be right beside where the Germans are building the Berlin to Baghdad railway.
There's competition among all the different European powers to woo the Ottomans. So the British are building them a warship, the French are giving them loans, and the Germans are building a railway. And these are all different ways of these different European powers to position themselves if, as seems likely, the Ottoman Empire disintegrates. People have been waiting for this for about 200 years. And of course, it hasn't happened partly because the different European powers all have an interest in keeping it from the others. And so in order to avoid, particularly the Russians, getting the straits, all these different powers just keep the Ottomans there intact.
So we've got the Germans who are there. We've got the British who are sending out young men to do walking and surveying, maybe. And who else is sort of in this scramble for the Ottomans?
The French are there. The French have their eye on Syria very much. Oh, and the Russians, obviously, and, who are concerned about who's going to be controlling the Turkish Empire.
So it's a time of great intrigue.
Yeah, intrigue and spies and meeting in smoky rooms and having smoky discussions.
And within Istanbul, there's huge political unrest. For example, the Armenians are now about to be fingered as traitors to the empire. They're feeling uncertain. Then there's Armenian nationalists, two different kinds of Armenian nationalists competing with each other. It's a fascinating time for Lawrence to be there.
Okay, so all of these powers are there, present, intriguing, pretending they're not waiting for the whole thing to collapse and walk in and take bits of the Ottoman Empire. It feels like there may be some war on the horizon. What's Lawrence doing at this time?
Well, Lawrence is digging at Carchemish and falling in love with a young man.
Is the young man Dahoom.
This is the young man Dahoom. I don't think they have a sexual relationship. Just very quickly, let me make this clear. It's an absolutely platonic love. I don't think sex was part of Lawrence's thing.
But he writes about him so passionately in this. What is the work that he writes? Something of Zim. What's it called?
The Wilderness of
Zim.
They end up, in the winter of 1913, they are asked to go and look for the archaeological traces of Moses and the children of Israel, and which even they know is ridiculous. And they're going with a couple of royal engineers, and they're going because Lord Kitchener, who had been a royal engineer and at this point is the ruler in the British in Egypt, knows that there's one bit of this desert route between Palestine and Egypt and the Suez Canal, which is the route to India and therefore absolutely central to British power. There's one bit that the Royal Engineers did not map. And so he has requested the Palestine Exploration Fund to ask for permission to send Lawrence and Dahoom and Woolley to go and map this bit with a few engineers, Royal Engineers.
That's so interesting because that's actually a little bit how espionage worked in Asia. They sent people up the Himalayas to map bits that might be useful and then put their findings into little bottles and send them down rivers. So, and you know, there was all of this kind of into the hands of spooks, this stuff went into. Okay, so he's done that. He's, tell me a bit about Dahoom, the man who stole his heart.
Dahoom was a boy. I mean, probably 12, 13, when Lawrence first sees him in 1910. He's the poorest, the most junior of, there's like 200 locals working on the excavation at Carchemish. And so this is the guy who brings water on his donkey for the diggers to drink. But there's something about him, apart from his good looks, that Lawrence, that inspires Lawrence. And it's partly that he's the only one of the 200, according to Lawrence, who's learned how to write any Arabic script. They're all illiterate. And so Lawrence says, well, with the money we're paying you, and the British Museum was paying cash, and most of the work these people did was barter.
Right.
With this money, what are you going to do? And Dahoom says, I'm going to get myself an education. So Lawrence thinks, I'm going to educate you. So he does. And he's very specific. He doesn't want to give him a Western education. He said, I hate these sort of half Westernized people. I want him to be the best Arab he can be.
And he dedicates, I mean, he will dedicate the seven pillars.
He dedicates the seven pillars to
him. But also, I mean,
more than that, he actually says, everything I did for this person who I cared about.
Which is beautiful. And okay, I mean, you're sticking to this. It wasn't sexual. And that's fine.
Ian Foster tried very hard to get Lawrence to admit to a physical relationship. And in the end said, this man is sexless.
Okay. And there's one thing that comes out in your book. You actually say, this is a man who didn't like to be touched. I mean, how do you know this about him?
There's a certain sort of touching he liked. He liked to be flagellated after the war.
He paid.
People
there
to whip
so
him.
Many public school jokes I could make by now, but
I think it's to do with his mother. Actually, I think that's to do with his mother and the beatings he received from her. He really wasn't a stroker or a fondler, and he was even sort of a bit weird about people shaking his hand.
Okay,
really, like Trump?
Yeah,
yeah.
Trump didn't like people shaking his hand.
No. Famously so. Okay, so then he's with Dahoom. He's living his best life in many ways. You know, he's digging, he's out, he's sleeping under the stars. He's got this beautiful boy at his side.
And as war approaches, there's absolutely no certainty which side the Ottomans will fall on. The French are the people that have lent the Ottomans money. And it's one accident, partly responsibility of Churchill, that shoves the Ottomans into the war on the side of the Germans. And that's when there's two warships being built in South Shields. And
South Shields, we should say, is a part of Northern England, a port in the
north.
A port
of Newcastle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the Ottoman state has borrowed a huge amount to have these ships built. They're going to be the pride of the new Ottoman Navy. And there's a massive campaign, I think, to raise money from ordinary people in the Ottoman Empire to pay for these two new state-of-the-art battleships. And just at the wrong moment, Churchill, who up to now has been saying, no, we're not going to send the ships because they're not quite ready. They need a little bit more of a polish. A couple more welders need to be found. And eventually he says, no, we're going to impound them.
Right.
And that impounding of the warships puts the entire Ottoman Empire into bed with the Russians. Okay. And about a week later, the Germans and the Ottomans sign a treaty and the Ottomans enter the war opposed to the British. And
this is World War One is that has begun. Where is Lawrence the day it's declared?
He's in Oxford.
He's gone back. He's left Dahoom.
In June 1914, he goes back to Oxford to complete this map. I mean, Kitchener has ordered them back. So he's left everything. He's seen the Ottoman Empire falling apart. And he's seen the Italians have bombarded Beirut Harbor, for instance, and things like that. I mean, he's seen the Ottomans lose their European territories. He's seen there were talk of an Armenian and then a Kurd uprising and the Arab Congress and all this stuff. He's seen all that. I mean, and yet he still doesn't understand that a war is coming.
He doesn't see it. He doesn't call it.
Everything in Carchemish in June and goes back.
We're thinking he's going to be back in a couple of weeks.
Including his revolver. And later on he says, God, imagine I got shot by my own revolver. How uncomfortable would that be?
Well, listen, it's a good time to take a break. Join us after the break when war has begun and where's Lawrence and what's he going to do? Welcome back. You're listening to Empire with me, Anita Arnand.
And me, William Dalrymple.
And our very, very special guest, Anthony Sutton, who has us on the edge of our seats, talking about the young Lawrence, the real Lawrence of Arabia. Teeny tiny Lawrence of Arabia. But look, a huge figure for a reason. So war has broken out. He didn't see it coming. That's where you left us just before the break. What is the response of Britain and when do they deploy Lawrence, and do they know what they want him to do?
Lawrence, yes, he wants to sign up immediately. And everyone is saying, you can't, you can't. Hogarth is saying, don't, wait. And so by the end of 1914, his brothers, his eldest brother and the third one have signed up, heading to the Somme and death and all that sort of stuff. But
do they die there?
Yeah, one dies in the battlefield. One's killed in a plane crash. And yeah, they die. But Lawrence finally gets a position as a second lieutenant in the map room in Cairo.
That's quite low, no?
Yeah, it's really low.
Which you might say is evidence that he wasn't already part of the intelligence services.
But this is the Arab Bureau, which has Hogarth at its head, which has all the archaeologists who've been working in including Gertrude Bell.
For those who don't know who Gertrude Bell is, she's a character. Now, do a thumbnail sketch of the extraordinary Gertrude Bell.
Gertie Bell.
Gertie Bell, to her friends, yeah.
As she was known, who was the daughter of a wealthy family. She had money behind her. She had a very good education and a lot of guts. And she traveled famously, not alone, because she had an entourage.
A constant companion yes, with her.
She traveled the whole way through the Middle East. She wrote extraordinarily good books. She was fascinated by the archaeology of the Middle East. And
a fluent speaker. I mean, she's one of those people who bothered to learn the language.
Yeah, exactly.
And in Cairo, you've got all these guys who have learned Arabic, Turkish, exactly, and know the region, but are not soldiers. They are archaeologists and map makers.
No, so this is the Arab Bureau, the intelligence department.
So she's in the Arab Bureau. You have a wonderful picture in your book. I mean, I don't know when it was taken. Is it the two of them?
Of Gertie with...
Gertie and Lawrence outside the pyramids.
That's right. No, that's after the war. When, just saying,
you've got a really good picture.
It's a good picture. Anyway, with Churchill on camels.
Yes. It's got literally everything in it. Okay, so there they are. There's this pool of characters. Oddballs.
They are a bit special. They are the misfits.
Yeah, they are a bit special. So then what are they doing and what are they then meant to do?
Well, they're there to try and work out, you have the Turks as enemies from Cairo up, and you have the Italians as enemies on the other side to the west, because the Italians have taken Libya.
And Lawrence
taken Libya.
Is actually first sent off to Iraq, isn't he?
He's sent off to Kut, where a massive British force has
largely been, from India.
Largely, yes, exactly.
And, Punjabis have just landed on a boat in Basra and marched inland.
And through stupidity of superior officers have got themselves surrounded and
besieged.
Lawrence is sent to try and negotiate. Probably
large numbers of Indians are dying.
Yeah. It's weird that he's sent. I mean, there's no reason.
He's a very junior officer with no brief,
but he understands Arabs. I mean, and he absolutely does. He gets them.
And not many Brits do understand Arabic at this point.
No. But anyway, that's a complete failure. So you'd imagine, he doesn't save the day. Right. You'd imagine that would sort of be the end of his career. So he's back in Cairo.
Having failed
and making such a nuisance of himself that
he's a pain in the neck. They don't like him, do they?
His commanding officer says, that man needs a good kicking.
and this is something that is actually very accurately portrayed in the movie, where he's the oddball who's quite keen on Arabs. And you have all these other British chaps sitting there who are...
You find him unspeakable.
You find him unspeakable and are the kind of, central casting British racists of the period who don't hang around falling in love with 12-year-old Arab boys or whatever Lawrence has been up to.
Well, exactly. And also that, Lawrence famously never wore a full uniform. Either he wouldn't turn up with his pips or his jacket or his whatever. And his commanding officers, who thought this was part of discipline and whatever, were just infuriated.
Well, everything he did was infuriated.
And this is, of course, where the movie opens, and we see Lawrence being taken from the map room and offered a special job.
Mm. Curiously, in fact, he's actually not offered the job. The job is the job of Sir Ronald Storrs, or he might be Reginald Storrs, I can't remember, who's the Oriental attaché. So he's sort of, another one of these extraordinary, massively overeducated, massively bright, ridiculous Brits who walks around in linen suits with the sort of sweat patches growing from under his armpits and down his back. And he's going on a mission to talk to the Sheriff Hussein in Mecca.
Yeah.
And Sheriff Hussein is absolutely central to the whole Arab revolt. He is alongside the Caliph, the Ottoman Sultan, the most important figure in the Muslim world. Because he is the
Sharif of Mecca.
The Sharif of Mecca, of the holy place.
And direct descendant of the Prophet.
And the direct descendant of the Prophet. Although there are lots of those around, it must be said. But no, there's a real status here. So Storrs is going to see Sharif Hussein, and Lawrence asks for permission to go with. He's not sent. And they're all saying, yes!
Get out of here! With you. You annoying, so, annoying
exactly.
man.
So off they go. And Storrs famously didn't talk to anybody he thought was
beneath his intelligence. So, yeah.
Which meant that he famously didn't talk to almost anyone at all. And it's in the summer, in this really sweaty journey down the Red Sea on this steamer, they start talking to each other and, you know, and become very good friends. And Storrs has immense respect for Lawrence. And so that helps Lawrence's standing. And also the fact that he speaks Arabic. And so there's the Sharif Hussein and the children.
And the idea is the same as the idea which failed in Iraq, that he's going to get the local Arabs to rise up and support the British war effort against the Ottomans.
Yeah, so I'm intrigued by this, because it's in the British interest to have these tribes unite and cause a nuisance to the Ottomans. Does he do that because he believes in the United Arab Kingdom, or does he do it because he wants to help Britain? What is his motivation? Because he is very successful, isn't he, in talking to people and getting them to work together.
I think it's both, actually. I've got a quote for you. In March 1915, he wrote, "I want to pull them, the Arabs, all together and to roll up Syria by way of the Hejaz, which is Mecca, in the name of the Sharif," which is the Sharif Hussein. "We hope we can rush right up to Damascus and biff the French out of all hope of Syria." 1915.
It's very prescient, isn't it?
He's a junior officer. And he also says at that same time to Hogarth, to his superior at the Arab Bureau, "Tell Winston," and this is therefore Winston Churchill, who's First Lord of the Admiralty at this point, I think, that we need a landing in Alexandretta, which is on the Syrian coast now.
The port of Antioch,
of Arabs, who will then take what in his view, the Arab lands from the Ottomans.
And Churchill chooses to go to Gallipoli.
Gallipoli, which is a disaster.
Well, probably Hogarth didn't tell Winston, or if he did, Winston
said, well, who the hell is he?
Yeah, really. Second lieutenant
from nowhere.
In actual fact, it would have been a very good idea. It would have been. The Arabs may well have raised that, and he would have saved the Armenians. He would have had the Armenian genocide.
It would have been brilliant. Okay. It would have been brilliant. That would have been a masterstroke. But it didn't happen. So what did happen is he goes to Arabia with Storrs, and he is checking out the sons of the...
Where's Dahum?
Dahum is still in Carchemish.
So they don't reunite.
They don't see each other. Well, that's a spoiler.
Okay. No good. I don't like spoilers. It's fine. No, you're allowed to tell me that. I'm doing it to William all the time. All right.
No, Dahum's back in Carchemish.
Okay.
And we know he's still in Carchemish at this point.
Okay. But there he is giving very good advice, Lawrence, that nobody's listening to.
And he spots Faisal as the coming man.
This man is so important. Who is Faisal? Man of the day.
One of Emir Hussein's... the Sharif's sons, and there are lots of sons. There's Ali, and Faisal is not the obvious one. He's not the eldest son, but Lawrence thinks he's the one. Other people think this as well.
Why?
Because there's a solidity to him. There's a sense of measured judgment about him, and Lawrence thinks rightly so, that the others are either too rash or
feckless.
Exactly. They don't have the weight of this man.
So how quickly does the idea of the attack on Aqaba appear after this?
This is really interesting, because this is one of the most famous things that Lawrence is associated with is the capture of Aqaba, and which transforms the view of the Arabs as far as the British or the Allies are concerned. And in Faisal's notebooks, in his letters, and in his biography, it's insisted that Lawrence was at no point part of the negotiations of what they were going to do.
Really?
But Lawrence absolutely claims it as his idea.
So who's telling the truth?
Well, we'll never know. But what is certain is that... So as far as the British were concerned, you have these Arabs, and they have already declared a revolt. So famously, this old man, the Sharif Hussein, fires his rifle from the top of his palace in Mecca, but actually nothing very much happens.
But it's a huge symbolic moment.
But it's very symbolic. Yeah. And so the British are thinking, we must be able to fire this sort of louder.
And just again, to the contrast with Kut. In Kut, the British had worked very hard to get the local Arabs to rise up against the Turks. They thought that, quite rightly, that many of the Arabs would be very upset with the Turks, that they wouldn't feel any loyalty to the Turks. And it was a complete failure in Iraq. But that's not the case now. When that rifle goes off and it's led by the Sharif of Mecca, it's a completely different thing.
The British have promised Arabs independence after the war. McMahon, who is the commanding officer, has written letters to the Sharif Hussein promising independence. Aqaba is really important because up until then, the British had not considered the Arabs a viable force. It's like, well, okay, they're there. They've established their revolt, but actually nothing's happening. So you can't use them. They don't have weight in this global war. You know, and the point about Aqaba is all the Turkish guns famously are facing the water because it's a port, and the Turks had assumed that the port would be stormed from sea, and especially by the British, who are a naval power. The Arabs go around the desert, which is a hellish journey. I mean, it's really, really
difficult. I've actually done that journey. I've retraced the...
It's not easy, is it?
Yeah, not easy at all.
What, were you on a camel? How did you do it?
I was in Lankreese, in fact.
Lankreese, okay. Slightly easier then. Yeah, okay.
It didn't take 40 days across the desert for me. Uh-huh. But it's still a very, very bleak and daunting and fantastic desert.
Yeah, it is. And they attack famously behind.
And it's a huge success.
It's a huge success, except not for Lawrence, who shoots his camel and falls off.
Why does he shoot?
Oh, that doesn't happen in the movie.
No, it doesn't happen in the
by
movie.
By accident?
Yeah, by accident.
Okay, that's good. Okay, good.
I know. It's not very heroic.
Not really, no.
He has managed to persuade several tribes to come together for this attack, and on the promise that there is gold in Aqaba. And if you remember the movie, there's Anthony Quinn saying, "Where's the gold?"
Yes, yes, yes.
But also, if you remember the movie, and this does happen, Lawrence is very keen for this to be known in Cairo that the Arabs have taken Aqaba. Yeah. So he makes this ridiculous journey by camel with one of the tribe.
In the movie, it's one of the tribe. In reality, I think it's three or four.
Yeah,
with him.
Yeah, that's right.
So in the movie, it's this terrible scene, isn't it? When they arrive and they're hot and they're sweaty, they get these terrible looks because he's brought an Arab.
He's gone into the officers' club and says, "Serve this man." It's like, he's not allowed in here. He's a bloody foreigner.
And
it's true. Yeah. But the significance beyond the social side of it is that at that point, the British military, the headquarters understands that actually something could be done with these Arab fighters. Lawrence is encouraged, sent back with a massive amount of gold. I mean, you could say that the Arabs were fighting for independence, but actually they were fighting for gold. And the equivalent of hundreds of millions of dollars were handed over in gold.
And railways start getting blown up, communications get cut, and it begins to work. This is actually something that's really taking off.
Well, when you say they start cutting, I mean, that is this the first sighting of guerrilla warfare that, you can't take on a whole army?
Exactly.
Just snip away at different bits.
Lawrence realizes that the Arabs couldn't fight a pitched battle with the Ottomans. So
they have maxim guns and all the modern equipment.
Exactly. But
the Germans are shipping great quantities of stuff to Istanbul. The latest German weaponry are arriving, including planes.
Yeah. But you don't have to face them.
Lawrence describes these armies as being like plants. They're rooted. And he said, suppose we could be like vapor. We could just waft here and there and pop up, and which is effectively the beginning of guerrilla warfare.
Amazing.
And that's exactly what they do. So they decide, there's a large Turkish garrison in Medina, and they decide they're not going to take it on. They're just going to cut it off.
And this provides cover for the British, who are now moving up from Cairo, to think of invading Palestine under Allenby.
That's right.
But at the same time as all this is going on, and the Arabs are being promised independence and everything, two other people are being promised the same thing. One is the Zionists are being promised a homeland in Palestine.
The Balfour Declaration.
And secondly, the French are being offered great chunks of the Middle East in the Sykes-Picot agreement. The same thing is being offered to three people at once. So, of course, the whole thing is going to grow up.
Does Lawrence know?
He doesn't know when he starts out
because
in 1916.
He's offering this to the Arab friends of his in good faith.
Risking their lives for their independence. Yeah. So at the same time, it's being offered to the French.
That's right.
And indeed, to be directly ruled by the British.
That's right. And it comes out in 1917 when the Guardian newspaper get hold of it because of the Soviet Auschwitz, pass it to, get hold of a copy, pass it to after the Russian Revolution, pass it to the Guardian newspaper. And Lawrence, at this point, whether he already knew it or not, goes to his commanding officer, or actually writes a note to Cairo saying, I can't bear it. We have them fighting on a lie. I'm going off to get myself killed. And he literally disappears for days, and we don't quite know what happened.
Is that the moment at Deraa when he walks in and gets himself arrested?
Well, Deraa is exactly around that period. And Deraa is such a weird and unlikely event.
Well, now you two know about it. I have a clue about it. But this is a really absolutely appalling thing to happen to a human being. Talk
so Lawrence,
what happens.
Is, again, to remind everybody, is blonde and blue-eyed and unusually small.
And
walks into Deraa.
Which is being held by the Ottomans.
Which is the main Ottoman.
Which is Syria and near the Jordanian border now.
And what happens?
And he gets picked up because, you know,
he's shining like a Felicia beacon.
Exactly. Yeah. Really. And taken to the local commander who has him, first of all, interrogated and beaten up and whatever else. And then, I mean, everybody knows about Lawrence by then because he's been blowing up their trains. I mean, he's a character in the region. And then has him sent upstairs to his bedroom, where it appears that he was raped and then thrown out in the street the next day. And what he writes, because he doesn't, those are not the words he uses, he says that his integrity was defiled.
But what was he up to? He didn't have to go into Deraa.
Well,
he said
he was
going to
go get himself killed. He did try quite hard. I mean,
it's so strange.
In the film, Peter O'Toole is shown sort of falling apart, sort of drinking too much and sort of talking to himself and disillusioned. Is that a close approximation of what you think happened?
He's really struggling. I mean, it's interesting because
he's got all these people to rise up to risk their lives, and he knows that they're going to be
completely shafted
by the British. Yeah.
And he's absolutely caught in the middle between these two sides because he wants independence for the Arabs and he wants the British to win the war. And for a while, he could see these two things going along very happily. And at this point, he's realized that actually that's not going to happen. And after the war, he writes, it's a terrible thing to be caught between two cultures. And he describes it as a Yahoo life. You know, that you're neither one thing, nor you're never again.
It's a famous quote.
Never again are going to be one thing or the other.
So just to follow this through. So by now, lots of Indian troops have arrived in Egypt in large numbers, including Rajasthani cavalry regiments, camels, all the rest of it.
My father's friend, Brigadier Diljit Virk.
He's there too. And they move up through Gaza. They fight a battle at Ashkelon and they take Palestine. And meanwhile, what is Lawrence doing in the rear?
Well, no, Lawrence isn't in the rear. He and the Arabs are moving up
on the coast, in the
desert. So Allenby's moving up on the fertile land is a sort of classic settled and nomad story. And so Allenby and the British army and Australians and whoever else are moving up on the fertile land, and the Arabs are going up through the desert.
We've only got a little while left on this, and I do want to put something to you. He is interesting, but he's not of enormous importance in the scheme of the British war machine. But there is one thing that then elevates him to the Lawrence of Arabia that we have now, which, when are the Lowell Thomas films being made? These are films that suddenly focus in on the white man dressed as an Arab, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Lowell Thomas is an American journalist with news cameras, and he's come to try and find stories that are going to keep the American public on side with the Americans coming into the First World War. And he's in Jerusalem when Allenby and Lawrence have famously walked in rather than ridden in to this holy city to show their sort of, you know, humility. Allenby says, well, if you're looking for a story, go with Lawrence. He's blowing up trains. And so Lowell Thomas and his film crew are literally there filming Lawrence and the Arabs going down and blowing up these Turkish trains.
Yeah. If you go to Wadi Natrun in Jordan today, you can see recreations of this every day for Thomas.
but also, I mean, at home, this is playing like a sensation. So Lawrence himself describes himself, I think, rather dismissively as, I am just a matinee idol now. But Lowell Thomas realizes that every time he shows this man on his screens back at home, the audiences go crazy. So, of course, he becomes quite obsessed with Lawrence. So that's how Lawrence kind of displaces everybody else and becomes Lawrence of Arabia. It's showbiz. I mean, it is a bit of showbiz.
So what is, in your view, Anthony, I mean, there are two views about this. You said that actually it's not a major thing for the British war effort. Would you agree with that? Is it a big thing for the British
war
effort?
No, I think without without Lawrence, it could have been someone else, but it was Lawrence. Without Lawrence keeping the Arabs on side. And actually
maybe Aqaba would never have happened without
Lawrence. No, exactly. And then, you know, they're the first into Damascus. And without keeping the Arabs together, and he understood how to keep these tribes. He understood the temperament, which no other British officer in the field would have done.
So Lawrence takes Damascus, but in the movie, the Arabs sort of fall apart. They can't agree with each other. The whole thing, there's a fire, there's arson in Damascus. And Lawrence also is exposed at this point as having been representative of this lie that the Arabs are going to get everything. And in fact, they've offered it to the French and to the Zionists too.
Yeah, well, also, just outside Damascus, he's heard that Dahum has died. Dahum died of typhoid, probably in 1916, but Lawrence doesn't hear until literally just before Damascus. And so everything that he's imagined, you know, that he's going to hand these new Arab states and there'll be Dahum and Dahum will be part of it. And this whole gift, as he put it, has fallen apart. And he writes, so the first night in Damascus, the muezzin call faithful to prayer, and there's a special prayer said for the thanks for the salvation of Damascus. And Lawrence writes, for everybody else, it was a great moment except for me. I knew everything was lost. And then he asks Allenby for permission to disappear. I mean, he's a colonel at this point. He hands in his rank and wants to disappear. And he does. I mean, he literally disappears.
Out of shame because he's double-crossed his friends?
It's literally because he's failed. I mean, he tries once more in 1922, the Cairo conference, the 1919. He's there with Faisal.
He's representing Faisal, isn't he?
Faisal is not invited to this sort of post-war carve-up. And Lawrence gets him in and then fails with that. And then 1922, when Churchill takes on the colonial office, he asks Lawrence if he'll help him create a new order in the Middle East. And Lawrence lays out his rules. We're going to have Arab kingdoms. And Churchill agrees. And so Lawrence says, I'll do it for 1 year. And then after that, he changes his name and he enlists as a private in the army. He says, I never want responsibility again. I have failed.
He re-enlists as a private.
He changes his name twice keeps on re-enlisting because the press keep on finding him.
Right. He Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia. We've seen you on
exactly,
the movies.
Exactly.
Okay, right.
So he's enlisted as a private soldier. What happens to him after that?
He enlists as a private soldier. Then he ends up on the Northwest frontier, Pakistan, where he's translating the Homer, the Odyssey, actually, which is rather appropriate, I thought, for a man who travels. But the press find him and there's like all this story. What's Lawrence of Arabia doing in the Northwest frontier? There must be some, wherever he went.
Yeah,
there's always some story. For instance, what he really wanted to do after the war was go back to archaeology, go back to Carchemish. And the French say, we're not having Lawrence of Arabia.
Lawrence of bloody Arabia.
Wherever he goes, there'll be trouble. So they won't let him do that. So he keeps on being found. And eventually in the 1935, when he's coming to the end of, you know, the end of his career but he's a private still. I mean, he can go and have dinner with Churchill. The Lord of the Admiralty, the head of the Air Force, the head of the army, they're all friends of his, along with George Bernard Shaw and Ian Foster and the literary greats of the time.
Because by this stage, he's written the book. And it's not just a good book, it's one of the great books.
The Seven Pillars we're talking about.
But he hasn't published it, so it's not public knowledge because he doesn't want to, he knows what a fuss it's going to make. And it must be said that when it was published, it was the biggest selling book after the Bible. It sold an absolute fortune.
That's
and
a great
all
fact.
Of the royalties went to benevolent fund for widows of armed forces.
And then what happens? It's a very tragic end.
And then, so he's fine. And he has a lovely cottage, Clouds Hill, which is really his retreat. I mean, he only really had two homes of his own. One was a house he built at Carchemish, which you can go and visit. They've excavated it. Right. There's not very much of it to see, but he actually built that from scratch. And this lovely cottage called Clouds Hill in Dorset, which is now a National Trust. And it was kept exactly as it was on this day in 1935, where he's still being hounded by the press. And all he wants is to disappear and occasionally be whipped by one of his friends. It's not much to
ask. Oh, that's a floggy thing happening.
It's a floggy thing.
It carried on.
But he loves fast. First of all, he had a really expensive push bike when he was cycling through France. And then when he grew up, he had motorbikes. And he loved really fast motorbikes. And he was going fast. And he had just been into London to visit his friends, the editor of the Times and the Daily Mail or whatever, to persuade them to stop hounding him. Because, you know, everywhere he went, it was written up and he just wanted to disappear. Mm. So he was close to, and he says at this time, I wonder what it's like to be a leaf falling from a tree. Mm. There's really a sense of end about him. Mm. And anyway, he's going very fast on a Dorset lane, goes around a corner and a couple of kids on push bikes, and he swerves out of the way and has a motorbike accident and is in a coma for a few days and then dies.
Aged
35 plus 12.
Oh, you can't do maths either. Goodness me. It's 47.
Age 47. Age 46.
I can't believe historians who can't do maths.
He was 46.
It's very funny.
And at his funeral, Churchill gives the keynote address and says,
having ignored all his advice during the war,
says, we will never see his like again.
Yeah.
Anthony, you've given us really quite a sympathetic view of Lawrence, because there are those who say he's the great double crosser. He's conned the Arabs. He's led them all to risk their lives and then they've taken everything away. Whether or not you accept that he is basically acting with honor as far as he can in difficult circumstances, how far do you think he's actually responsible for so many of the problems of the Middle East today? Because of all the issues that are there, Israel, Palestine, Arab countries, tribes without flags that have no identity, split up along straight lines in the desert, unresolved issues of Turkey and the Arabs, no home for the Kurds, an Armenian genocide. Obviously, we can't put all of these at Lawrence's door. But how far do you think that the mess that he helped create is responsible for the mess of the Middle East today?
I think is absolutely responsible for it. And you know, he was a complex man, but and it's not really enough to say he was doing his best and in good faith, he really wanted the best for Arabs. Because I think even his view of his best case scenario was, you know, were a series of Arab states, each one run by the son of Sharif Hussein of Mecca, the Hashemite kingdoms, was, you know, would not have worked. I mean, it didn't work because for a little while, Faisal becomes king of Syria and effectively they don't want him. I mean, the Syrians are completely different people to the Hashemites. Mm-hmm. This is like trying to put a Frenchman on the British throne. It doesn't go down well. And I don't understand why he didn't.
The Prince of Orange has been made King of England. Various other variants of random Germans turning up and monarchy.
No, okay, that was a bad example. But I don't understand why he didn't understand that. And also, for instance, when he did his walk in 1909, he came out with an extraordinary comment walking through Palestine saying, I don't know why they don't give it all to the Jews. They seem to be the only people who can do anything with it. So a really complicated situation and no obvious solution and lots of good intentions. But yes, I think a lot of what he did has ended up making things worse.
Anthony, thank you very, very much. It's a very sad and moving story. Anthony, you've been wonderful. Thank you very, very much. Anthony Satin's book, Young Lawrence, A Portrait of the Legend as a Young Man, is available from John Murray. That's all we have time for today. But from me, William Dalrymple.
And me, Anita Arnand.
You can't do that.
How'd you like it? Sure. Yeah, I can.
That's my
if
thing.
You can do it, I can. And I will. And I might. How'd you like that? Anyway, it is goodbye from us. Goodbye.